From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, how some see Mary Burke as a different breed of Wisconsin Democrat. What the Bucks' hire of a new coach says about the team's new owners.
I have to believe that they have lost a certain amount of trust within certain segments of the community with this move, because there are several shady aspects to it, and when you're doing something shady, that doesn't really engender a whole lot of trust.
The Linden Sculpture Garden features work by women who are fascinated by science and nature, and a young self-taught photographer finds his greatest inspiration in his hometown.
I guess you could say I want people to, you know, look at my photos and feel like this is a city I want to live in. This is Milwaukee.
Lake Effect comes your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. It's nice to have you listening this morning. It is the first Tuesday in July, which means we are roughly 4 months away from Election Day, the first Tuesday in November. Wisconsin's race for governor will be among the most closely watched in the country, with Scott Walker facing his second challenge since he was elected 4 years ago. Walker, who dispatched a recall challenge in defeating Tom Barrett 2 years ago, will likely face businesswoman and former State Commerce Secretary Mary Burke. Following a profile of Governor Walker several months ago, Milwaukee Magazine focuses on Burke's history in its current issue. Associate Editor Claire Hannon wrote the profile, and she joins us in the studio now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me back, Mitch.
You quote a lot of analysts, a few analysts who have been following the Burke campaign, and the assertion that several of them make is kind of that she's not your typical Democratic politician in Wisconsin. What makes her different than the model?
Well, she's certainly not, and probably the biggest example of that is that she has been touting her business experience hard, and her experience with TREC, her experience with the Commerce Department, her, you know, kind of on the side offering free business advice. Her Harvard Business School degree. She has been touting that extremely hard, and that's why some of them even compared her to Ron Johnson. With his business background, he was also able to put a lot of his own money into the campaign, as Mary Burke has too. Yeah, so in that way, she's not your typical Democrat.
Well, and this is interesting because the Walker administration, when Scott Walker was first running for office, and since then, has really touted how friendly he and his administration have been to business as well.
Yeah, definitely. They have the renamed Commerce Department. They're just extremely different people. I think that was one of the things that really stuck out, especially after my colleague Matt wrote that very good article about Scott Walker in our May issue, just how different their backgrounds are. But in, I think, one very interesting way, they're very similar.
And that is?
Well, a lot of Matt's article talked about how, and a lot of articles since have talked about how unflappable Walker is. And you can't get the guy off message, can't really knock him down with anything. And Burke is equally unflappable. She's really getting the politician's touch when it comes to answering questions in a very diplomatic way, and all, you know, being able to kind of work the spin back to her campaign message. So I think the debates, if they have them, will be very interesting to kind of see who blinks first.
Or potentially very frustrating for the people asking the questions.
Oh, yeah, or it's going to be boring as heck.
Well, and now you've followed her to campaign stops over time since she announced for governor. How has her style evolved?
Well, she's gotten much more confident. She's gotten much more capable in, you know, giving a rallying speech that really she can kind of work up that fervor and that passion while she's speaking now that is it's very probably invigorating for her supporters. Whereas in the beginning, it was kind of stumble, just try to get the message out there.
So you're talking about her background. It's well known that she is the daughter of Dick Burke, the late founder of Trek Bicycles.
Yep.
How did her dad shape the businesswoman and maybe the woman overall that she became?
It's almost how didn't he shape her? She is so good at sticking on message. The only moments of real candor that I was able to witness were when she was talking about her dad. And those are really the only instances when she would go off message, was talking about how she really wanted to be like him. She wanted to follow in his footsteps. She looked up to his philanthropy, his business leadership, his kind of mentoring that he gave to people. And that was probably one of the, I don't know, starkest things.
Well, and you talk about philanthropy, and you relate her experience with the Boys and Girls Clubs mm-hmm. in Madison and what she essentially did kind of just, I don't want to say on a lark, but, you know, she has this has been a big and perhaps a little known part of what her background has been like.
Yeah. One of her friends told me that, well, Mary had been always involved in philanthropy, doing stuff through Trek too, but she really kind of put it into high gear after Dick died in 2008. And that's also when his children realized that he had made some huge donations that they never even knew about. The Urban Ecology Center is one. The Milwaukee Youth Arts Center is another. And that her friend said that was when she kind of stepped back, took a look at her life, and made some changes, became heavily involved in the Boys and Girls Club, leading it, revamping its finances, helping to find the new CEO, which led them to profitability, I think. In addition to all of these kind of side things, you know, donating almost $500,000 to a homeless shelter. So, and that was all kind of modeled after her dad, who is a pretty humble guy.
What sense do you get for what the business community's view of Mary Burke is?
Well, I think some of them are pleased that she's even talking about business in a way that other Democrats haven't. But there are others, like the former president of the Manufacturers and Commerce, who said he hasn't seen a concrete plan. Now, that could be because he hasn't read the 40-page Invest for Success, and because she definitely gets into some nitty-gritty in there. But I think people are kind of waiting for her to narrow that message down.
Well, and this seems emblematic of what some analysts say the challenge she has in front of her is, in general, this what is the message going to be?
Right. And one Madison political scientist told me that these 30-second ads, you know, while the attack ads sting, that format could really help her narrow it down into one soundbite. You know, I'm Mary Burke and I'm going to help with this and this.
If she is not your typical Democratic politician in Wisconsin because of her interest in business and business ties, how is she like a typical Democratic politician in Wisconsin? Because, you know, there are obviously going to be some voters who would look to her as being much different from Scott Walker.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the sort of social issues, she's pretty liberal. She has also said she would try to restore collective bargaining. So, and, you know, that's a financial issue, too. So in kind of those big ways, she aligns with the Democrats. And she used to even call herself an independent and then kind of realized, well, most of my beliefs align with the Democratic Party. And so that's where I kind of have a home.
She and, of course, she grew up in a pretty Republican area.
Yeah, Waukesha County in Heartland.
You spent time with her at campaign stops in addition to sitting down with her one-on-one. What kind of sense did you get for how she relates to just regular people?
She has this inquisitiveness about her that I thought was genuine. It didn't seem like a show. And she just really takes this whole kind of fact-finding that she's doing very seriously and asks, you know, everyone and their mother, why are you doing what you're doing? How do you feel about this? What can we change to make you happy? She told me about one lady's biggest problem was with the hours of the DMV. And she sat and talked to this lady about the DMV hours. I mean, she can question very well. And that's kind of interesting because usually you only see the other side, people grilling her.
Well, and so in the course of doing this, did you get a sense for the answer to, you know, the big question, you know, why her and why governor, why she thinks that of all the people in the state, she ought to be in the executive mansion?
Well, I think she's extremely smart. I think that comes across in a lot of what she says and a lot of the interviews she gives to other outlets. She's smart. She's accomplished. She is methodical. And I think she really wants to take that kind of approach to breaking down all the different agencies and, you know, saving money where you can, spending on things where you can. I think she's got kind of an accountant's approach to that. And I think she's probably very dissatisfied with the current leadership and, I guess, saw a hole. She's also never really failed at much. So I think she's got that in the confidence department.
Well, between this article and the profile of Scott Walker a couple of months ago, it's a lot for voters to take a look at. Should be an interesting few months ahead of us. Claire Hannon, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Claire Hannon is associate editor of Milwaukee Magazine. Her profile of Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mary Burke is in the July issue. Claire's colleague at the magazine, senior editor Howie Magner, is our sports contributor. He joins us to talk about the sudden hiring of a new coach for the Milwaukee Bucks when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. The new owners of the Milwaukee Bucks made a big deal of getting to know the community in recent weeks. Mark Lazary and Wesley Edens met with Milwaukeeans and talked about their plan to rehabilitate the basketball franchise, which finished in the NBA cellar last year and which is seeking support for a new downtown arena. The team went out and used their number 2 pick in the NBA draft to select potential star Jabari Parker, but 2 future draft picks are making for a major change in course this week. The Bucks yesterday traded 2 second-round picks in years to come for Jason Kidd, the coach of the Brooklyn Nets, until, well, yesterday. Howie Magner is our sports contributor, and he joins us by phone to talk about this sudden change behind the bench. Hi, Howie.
How you doing, Mitch?
Just fine, thanks. What do we know about how Jason Kidd found his way to Milwaukee in particular, and maybe how this transaction began?
Well, I think we don't know enough at this point, and that's part of the problem, is that this transaction was handled in such secrecy that all the reports out there are that the owners didn't even inform the Bucks front office of the negotiations until the negotiations were broken by a New York Post report. So apparently the Bucks owners, Mark Lazary and Wesley Edens, were interested in hiring a new head coach for the team, and Bucks general manager John Hammond didn't even know about it. That kind of creates a bit of an awkward situation when, as the general manager of the team, you're supposed to hire coaches and fire coaches, and it created a real awkward situation for Larry Drew, considering that he was still the head coach of the team. So apparently the Bucks hired a new head coach while they still had a head coach, and word has leaked out as of, I want to say around 11 o'clock Monday morning, that Larry Drew had in fact been fired.
Well, and perhaps even before any of this began, there's this idea that Jason Kidd was unhappy with the Nets.
Well, word is that he tried to make some type of power play with the Nets. And for people who aren't familiar with Jason Kidd's history, he was a rookie head coach last year, right after a stellar career as a player in the NBA, point guard, really one of the best point guards that the game has ever seen. But it was a bit of a surprise when he was hired to coach the Brooklyn Nets now, with no head coaching experience, because the Russian owners of the Nets had poured something like $100 million into last year's payroll, and here they were entrusting that payroll to a guy who'd never held a coaching position before. And he got off to a bit of a rocky start with them. They lost 20 of their first 30 games or something like that, and there were rumors that he was really going to get fired, and he had some internal combustion with his assistant coaches, and it was a bad deal. But he turned the team around midway through the season and actually made the playoffs with the Nets, and they won their first-round series before bowing out to the Miami Heat. And then a couple of other first-year head coaches were hired without any head coaching experience, and they got about twice as much money as Jason Kidd had gotten on his contract. So apparently Kidd went to the Brooklyn owners and said, look, I want a big raise, and I also want more power within the organization. The Nets owners said, well, no, we're not going to do that. And his next move, apparently, was to go ahead and seek out a role within the Bucks organization. So it should be said that he did all of that, made that whole power play with the Nets without knowledge of his own general manager. So he kind of tried an end around to get to the owners, and the owners said no, and in the end supported their own general manager. Well, all that transpires, and here you can kind of see a similar end around being played in him getting the job here with the Bucks.
Well, and so he was upset that he didn't have more control over things with the Nets. The Bucks have only reportedly hired him as the head coach. Are you feeling nervous if you're the Bucks general manager at this point?
I would think that there are some nerves, especially when you consider the fact that he supposedly didn't even know that the interviews were going on for the head coaching position. But Jason Kidd has a history of being very ambitious and getting more power wherever he's at. And if you're a man like John Hammond, then you have to at least wonder whether or not that same fate is going to befall you. And Jason Kidd has a very close relationship with Mark Lazary, one of the new owners of the Bucks, and that's basically the reason why Kidd is here in Milwaukee.
At the end of the day, the new owners presumably have the right to put whoever they want behind the bench and in the front office.
Absolutely, and I don't think anybody disputes that. Look, they wrote a check for $550 million. That's an awful lot of money for a basketball team, and when you do that, you have the right to do whatever you want to do with that basketball team. I think the main issue that people are having with this move is that the way that they went about it. People are basically saying, look, if the Bucks really wanted to make a run, if the new owners really wanted to make a run at Jason Kidd and they didn't think that Larry Drew was going to be part of the future, well, then fire Larry Drew up front. If you want to do this with or without the blessing of John Hammond, I don't even think you have to ask John Hammond's opinion. You can just go into John Hammond and say, look, here's what we want to do. We don't care whether or not you like it. This is what we want to do. But you at least loop in your front office on your plans, because you're really kind of going behind his back to do his job for him. So and that really kind of leads to a bit of a trust fallout. I have to believe within the Bucks organization, when you see the new owners coming in and making a move like this, you certainly have to wonder, well, is that how every move is going to be made? And then I think people from outside of the organization have to wonder how this impacts the trust between the Bucks and any potential supporters they might have when it comes to building a new arena here in this city. I think one of the biggest jobs that the Bucks owners have right now is earning the trust of this community and putting that trust toward the goal of building a new arena. And I have to believe that they have lost a certain amount of trust within certain segments of the community with this move, because there are several shady aspects to it. And when you're doing something shady, that doesn't really engender a whole lot of trust.
There are some who are saying that this is a sign that the Bucks are, if nothing else, becoming more ambitious.
Well, there's certainly no doubt about that. I mean, say what you want about how they did it, but it certainly is a bold move, and they've gone out and gotten a pretty high-profile guy. This has nothing to do with whether or not Jason Kidd is a good coach or a better coach than Larry Drew, or whether or not he might be a better general manager down the line than John Hammond. I think it's certainly possible that Kidd could be a very good coach for the Bucks, and he could mold the young talent that they have there in that organization into a winning team. But the way he's coming on board certainly leaves a bad taste in the mouth of many people who are observing the Bucks these days, particularly in the national media and many in the local media as well.
Howie, thanks.
Thanks, Mitch. Take care.
Howie Magner is senior editor and writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine, and he is our regular sports contributor. Keep listening. When we return, we'll talk about some of the many accents and dialects that shape how we talk in Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke. Pickle Patch, Bubbler, Tavern Belly, Brats. Wisconsinites have regularly employed a colorful and unique vocabulary thanks to multiple waves of immigration from the 1800s through the present. But there's also incredible diversity in language use in different areas of the states and even within single cities. A book written last year by a collection of linguistic scholars expounds on our state's history, policy, and culture towards language. Eric Ramey is professor of English language and linguistics at UW-Madison, and Thomas Purnell is a professor of English at UW-Madison. They're the co-editors and contributors to Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. They talked with Lake Effect's Rachel Bloom last year about Wisconsin's rich cultural and linguistic heritage, which extends to both accents and dialects.
Wisconsin has been known for having a particular sort of accent or dialect from the upper Midwest area, and people tend to joke about that and think primarily in those terms. But there's a lot going on with language here that's sort of separate from English. In our book, we have a chapter on Native American languages, and I think this is the starting point, but also taking through immigration, both old immigrants like German, Polish, and also new immigrants such as Hmong and Spanish speakers. We picked four communities that we were very interested in because we felt that they had unique characteristics. So we picked Milwaukee because we felt like with the African-American community and the intersection with and sort of the issue of race and language, that was really important. We also picked Wausau because we felt like that was important because they had two groups of old immigrants and two groups of new immigrants. And we wanted to try to see how we could help them to learn from the past of the old groups. We also picked Mineral Point because we felt like that was very different. It's a different part of the state altogether in terms of the speech patterns. We felt like that was an important
– Southwestern.
Southwestern, right. And then we picked Rhinelander, which also was important for sort of as a center for Native American language issues as well as also for issues dealing with the Northwoods aspect, that both the perception of Northwoods individuals and also their language might be different from sort of this Germanic – you know, dominant area in the southeast.
I noticed that in many instances, members of various immigrant and native communities were forced to assimilate their language and culture and conform to standard English. But then I was surprised to read that Wisconsin actually established an emigration office in the mid-1800s, specifically to attract Germans to settle the state. Do you think that this cultural acceptance of Germanic culture affects the way we speak in Wisconsin today?
That's a good question. Not being from Wisconsin here, I think the history of actually trying to recruit or advertise Germans to come here specifically explains and provides, you know, the basis for why so many Germans came here. We can see the hallmarks of the large amounts of European migration in here in contemporary dialects of Wisconsin. But whether this actually leads to more acceptance of immigrants or immigrant languages here or there, I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think that's still for us to decide in the future of how we treat new immigrant languages and old immigrant languages too.
But I think when you look at all these cases in the book, the immigrants come here, period, and then language issues follow. And so those language issues and follow sort of fall out in a particular pattern. And there's a lot to be learned from some of those patterns, like the German pattern, how German in a sense was used in Milwaukee particularly or throughout the state, but then has sort of given way to English in many ways and how they were in tension for a while. And then you see that now, I mean, with Spanish and with Hmong, how within those communities there's also a tension and how there's a transition taking place. And we have a lot to learn from what happened with those older immigrants with the new immigrants.
That is true. In my personal opinion, one of the most interesting things here is actually the difference between the older immigrants and the newer immigrants in that it appeared that it took the older immigrants, so the good old German immigrants, much, much, much longer to transition over to English as opposed to the new immigrants, especially the Spanish-speaking immigrants. They are transitioning over to English much quicker now, as quickly as they possibly can, as opposed to the older immigrants that took 3-4 generations to do so.
And some of that has to do with societal pressures. So there's a lot of framework with regard to schools, churches, and family life in terms of having immigrants come in or old immigrants come in. And with the state, in a sense, advertising come here, you had some setup and some tolerance of that. And I think nowadays there are still churches. There are churches that have Hmong that's spoken in or Spanish. You'll see once those start to switch over to English, then you're going to start to lose a lot of the language. There's not a lot of the other structure. There are, you know, tiendas and so on and so forth. And those help maintain. So having, say, a hairdresser who speaks Hmong, and then the Hmong go there, that'll preserve the contact because you're engaging it in the language at that point. And without some of those structures and some of those peripheral things, the turnover is much faster. I think some of the pressures in society now are not as supportive of language maintenance as they were in the past.
So there is a big community element in the practice of these languages.
Correct.
What are some of the linguistic mannerisms that are found in Wisconsin, and why is it important that we know about them?
It's always important to sort of know where you're from. That's one aspect of it. And it's also important to know where the other person that you're talking to is from. And identity and cohesion in a conversation is important to anybody. So usually when students live in Wisconsin and then they go out of the state for a while, all of a sudden it's apparent that something's different about their speech. And there's a number of markers, both in syntax and in the sounds, and then in also the words that they use. And those markers mark them out as being different from the place that they've gone to visit. Something that we might actually associate more with Chicago, which is the Bears, the Bulls. But you find this also in Packers, right, where people will make an S sound when it should be like a Z sound. But this happens in German, it happens in Dutch, it happens in a number of languages, and we wanted to look at the influence. We found that younger speakers actually took that as a marker and worked that into their speech more often than, say, even their previous generation. And that was remarkable. So that got us thinking that there's a lot going on in Wisconsin that's really interesting.
One of my favorite discussions in class is telling the class of nice Wisconsin-born students and all of you Wisconsin listeners that Wisconsin is unique and weird in having the past tense of the verb to dive into a pool as dove. And this is unusual with the rest of the country. And so when people occasionally look down on somebody for using the wrong tense of something, it makes people rethink their judgments when they find out it's like, oh, by the way, your behavior of I dove into the pool, people not from around here may hear you say that and think that, you're uneducated because obviously the past tense is dived. So one of the things of knowing what are the unique markers of a particular community or a speech group, I think allows people to think about their own judgments about differences in other groups of speeches.
And you bring up an interesting point, I think, about what we consider standard English and how there are actually many different types of standard English. Some forms might use a different past tense, like dove, as you said. In academic settings, what we call formal standard English is usually used. But what makes this different from some of the other forms of standard English? What about informal standard English?
Oh, the different types of formal versions of language is really defined by kind of who makes the decision or who defines what is standard or not. So formal standard English is defined by groups of experts and basically books. And we also want to recognize that the only really real version of formal standard English is written English, is that it's only when it's written can it actually be formal standard. And you can look up in a book, Descriptive Grammar of English, of the writing rules of this is how you do it. The informal standard of English is a variety spoken, and this is completely defined by local communities. So using dove as the past tense of dive is standard here in Wisconsin because that's how the community behaves. The community has decided for that. It is not standard, say, in Western Pennsylvania where I grew up. And so the standards really differentiate by who has the power to decide what they are. And the version that everybody thinks exists, this formal standard English, is just purely in books. Whereas the actual, in my opinion, more important, the local informal standard is completely community driven. And it's the community that you grow up with and feel most comfortable with and belonging to. Everybody learns what the standards are there on their own. And then you can see where people deviate from them.
The greatest deviation usually occurs in ones that are ethnically affiliated. Historically, in the United States, that's been with the African-American English community. In terms of the choices that that community makes about language, they're not really choices in the sense that we think, oh, okay, I'm going to make this choice. I have a choice that way. But in terms of the way that it's developed over time and the whole history of African-American English, it sets itself out from standard white English in many particular ways. So that whole issue about standardization, particularly in the schools, in terms of the workplace, those are going to come up strongest in communities that have the most divergent speech forms, generally African-American English speech communities and also, say, even the Chicano English speech community.
Do you think that it's important that children are introduced to these different forms of English in school, that they have an understanding of dialects different than their own?
That's actually important. So there's two ways to take your particular question. One way to take it is a child who speaks a non-standard variety, should they be exposed, say, to other varieties such as standard? And so that's generally the sort of big thing talking about education and how non-standard dialect speakers should conform or not conform. But also the other way around, for standard students who are close to the standard, individuals close to the standard, should they be exposed to more non-standard varieties? And I think in many ways they are exposed to non-standard varieties through media and so on and so forth, also through their friends if they have more contact with non-standard speakers. And I think that's healthy just to understand it. If they also understand that the forms that other people speak are not right or wrong, then they don't develop some of the biases that we use that as a flag for that person who's different later in life. And it's very important. Although language gets used that way sort of automatically, we use it as a flag and it ends up being used in discriminatory ways. So I think it's important for children early on in schools not to be sort of homogenizing the community and then making those who can't manage that variety as being very different.
I really don't think the idea that kids aren't being exposed to varieties of non-standard dialects can be maintained at all, because even in standard Wisconsin English, all the children are being exposed both to the informal standard but then also the vernacular non-standard. You know, so like all of the kids know all the bad words. They hear us when we're talking freely. And so they're aware of variation in language there too. So if we begin to ask the question of like, is it helpful or harmful of them being exposed to other informal standard or other informal non-standards, they're already seeing and aware of the variation to begin with. And so I actually think in school, if you actually – the younger that you can start talking to the kids about this and teaching them about this, the better they can begin to manipulate and use and know, you know, you don't say those words because you don't say those words in those situations. And, you know, this other person talks differently, but that's just because they're from a different neighborhood and it doesn't mean anything like that. And so you can begin the discussion of manipulating language behaviors for everybody, which everybody does, in more productive ways. You know, so you teach people to go to job interviews in, you know, nice clothes. You know, you teach people to use nice language when you go to a job interview. But, you know, when you're sitting around on the playground with your friends, you don't have to use nice language, and it's okay.
Eric Ramey and Tom Purnell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Eric Ramey is professor of English language and linguistics at UW-Madison. Thomas Purnell is professor of English at UW-Madison. They're co-editors and contributors to Wisconsin Talk, Linguistic Diversity in the Badger State. They spoke with Rachel Bloom last year. Some art is in bloom just north of Milwaukee. A visit to the Linden Sculpture Garden when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. About 10 miles north of downtown Milwaukee, an astonishing collection of monumental sculpture resides on 40 acres of park and woodland. The parcel was the estate of Harry and Peg Bradley, whose legacies include the Allen Bradley Company and a breathtaking collection of art. Just over 4 years ago, the Bradley Place opened as the Linden Sculpture Garden. Recently, its executive director, Polly Morris, has incorporated a series called Women, Nature, Science. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz visited the current indoor exhibit. Before we meet the artist and her work, Morris explained how the series came to life.
I started this series a year or so ago because I was interested in other ways to connect what goes on outside with what goes on inside, and I had been looking at the work of various artists, all women, who look at science or nature or both and wanted to find a way to show them.
Polly Morris says she's tapping into interests she's heard from many who visit Linden Sculpture Garden.
We find that a lot of people who come to Linden are interested in the nature side of things. And the sculptures are not foremost in their mind. The fact that we have a gallery is not primary interest of theirs.
So Morris started with a New York artist who was captivated by Victorian women scientists.
And then I showed the work of Sheila Held, who makes tapestries. She's long been fascinated by the world of science.
The current exhibit features the work of fiber artist Kyung A. Cho. Although based in Milwaukee, Cho teaches at UWM's Peck School of the Arts. Moore says it wasn't easy pinning the artist down to a date.
Kyung A was on sabbatical last year, and we agreed that when she came back, we would do a show. And I was interested in showing her more formal work, which is very contained in many ways, very rigorous, full of repetitive actions. And then I wanted to show some of her alternate personality work.
Morris is referring to a hand-stitched quilt that floats from the rafters of the high-ceilinged space. It's a mass of colorful fabric petals.
I've been watching her work on this flower quilt for 8 years. So I said, the time has come. You have to finish this, and I want to show this. I also knew that she took these wonderful occasional photographs, mostly in her backyard, and they're incredibly close examinations of primarily bugs and flowers. Kyung A doesn't like to show any of these things. Yeah, they're really her research work. It's not what she puts out there in the world. But we made this arrangement that it would all face away from the gallery. Her real work could turn its back on her colorful work. And when we hung it in the beginning of April, it was still snowy outside. I see these people just poring over the photographs.
Morris explains the artist's real work, deeper within the gallery, reflects her connection to nature, the exploration of mortality. And Morris carefully adds,
she's working a lot here with hair, but Kyung A is a great saver of all things. I won't use the hoarder word. She'll collect something that interests her, whether it's a seedling or a leaf, twig, and she'll sit on it for as many years as it takes till she figures out how it's going to work its way into a piece of art.
Kyung A. Cho says growing up in South Korea, she had known nothing about fine art. As a child, she loved snapping photographs, as you've already heard, and creating things at school.
There's always somebody who's in charge of decorating room, and I was one of those, you know, learning sewing very, very young age from my grandma. And so I make doll clothing, and that led me to go to art school thinking that I was going to be a fashion designer because that's the only thing I knew. I mean, there's no artists around me.
Once in college, Cho's world expanded. She discovered her passion, fiber art for art's sake.
I love doing it. I never get tired of it. So kind of one thing led to the other, and then I decided to go study more.
That's when she came to the United States. Cho earned an MFA from Cranbrook Academy of Art in Michigan. She later taught at the Kansas City Art Institute before coming to Milwaukee. Cho returns home to South Korea every summer to spend time with her parents. They still can't quite fathom what it is she does for a living.
My parents keep asking, when are you going to make dress? Because that's what I thought it was going to be. Go look at the tree first. And okay. Then
Cho shows me a series fashioned around maple tree sprouts. The artist says she grew up with a reverence for trees.
After the war, there are a lot of buildings burned down, so growing trees seems like so long project. I always remember, but here, it's like maple. If you don't do anything, you grow like, you know. It's like, how the tree grow so fast here, you know?
Cho experiences a degree of guilt each time she weeds a wee maple out of her garden. She saved, actually still does, the most beautiful ones, carefully washes, dries them, before coating them with polyurethane.
Get a little coating so that gives a little support to stay longer.
Cho positioned each mini tree on pieces of salvaged gold-edged paper. She accents each with artfully burned, delicate dots.
This is a kind of burning tool, the engraving tool, and kind of thinking of yin and yang. Fire and wood can be a perfect match if in the right place. But if it's wrong place, it's disaster. So I think that idea of that balancing is always sort of embedded in my work. I'm thinking of also incense burning, and a lot of culture use that incense burning for kind of memorializing the death and, you know, so life and death, and something physical become smoke and disappear, and that whole two different world. So that whole idea is behind, but if nobody get it, that's fine, because first thing is a beautiful mark.
Would you start working in the corner with your burn marks, or does it just sort of happen?
Depending on the gesture, because to me it is a very gestural, very human figure. For me it's like dancing. And so the mark sort of comes to reveal the emotion that I connect with, kind of help viewer to see what I see.
So what emotion do you have there?
what is that, like sort of something is pulling in, you know, they're like center, but it's like, you know, tensions and sort of imagination happens. And I always call my work collaboration with nature.
This is
called marking with all.
Cho acknowledges some people might feel a bit squeamish with the raw material of the show's centerpiece, each 30 by 24 inches, titled Hair. Cho has always worn her hair very long, much to her mother's chagrin.
It's much more formal country than, I guess, Western, so there are certain things that expectation. As an older lady, you don't walk around with the long hair open. It's like my mom gets like really annoyed. It's like, just do something with the hair, you know. So every time I go, I braided my hair, and that still looks not fit to my age, to my parents, you know. So I knew that it's something I had to do something, because I'm still, you know, to respect the culture.
As Cho approached her 50th birthday, she decided to do something dramatic. When she made her annual trip to visit her parents, she would have her hair cut. But Cho lost her nerve when the only hairdresser she trusted retired. Cho shifted creative gears. Instead of cutting it, she would collect her hair as strands naturally fell out, rolled it into small balls, dozens and dozens of balls later.
I just decided to make a calendar.
24 of them, upon which she fused layer upon layer of fabric, adding fine, even stitches to create a gridded quilt effect. Cho sewed in a ring of her hair in the center of each calendar. This 50th year commemoration links back to her native land. She has long lived away from South Korea, but Cho says with every year she realizes the depth of her roots. As for the hair thing, her grandmother lived with her family when Cho was a child. She too had long hair.
Grandma and great-grandma both have old traditional bun hair, long hair. Every day they comb, they pile it up, and once a week the lady comes and buy that hair. And then she give a little candy money. It's not a lot of money, but in the candy money. But it's a kind of nice routine.
The hair was used to make wigs. When the era ended, Cho's grandma found another use for her hair.
She started making pincushion. So she never still threw away.
Cho says she seldom does so much talking about her work. She's much happier fashioning it. One day earlier, she spotted a poppy blooming in her garden. She dashed to capture a picture of it. One photograph turned into 250. Cho has no idea yet how that image will make its way into a future creation. For Lake Effect, I'm Susan Bentz.
Fiber artist Kyung A. Cho's exhibit called One at a Time continues at the Linden Sculpture Garden through July 13th. Tomorrow evening, Cho will share a picnic with visitors to the exhibit. WUWM environmental reporter spoke with Cho and Linden Sculpture Garden executive director Polly Morris. One last break now, and then we'll meet up-and-coming Milwaukee photographer Valen Gillette. Lake Effect returns right after this on WUWM. It's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Milwaukee's home to many good photographers, ranging from the strictly amateur to the internationally renowned. While he hasn't quite gotten to the second category yet, Valen Gillette is well on his way. His commercial work has been used by a number of businesses around town, and his fine art photography has gotten a great deal of attention as well. Not too bad for a guy barely into his 20s and self-taught to boot. Valen talked with Lake Effect's Bonnie North and explained his initial fascination with photography.
I liked how it can convey thoughts, but just by seeing it.
Thoughts, interesting.
It's for me, it's more of a visual response to how I see things. It's totally different. In my everyday life, I find that the most simplest thing can be beautiful, and I try to make the most of that.
But why photography rather than, say, painting or drawing or something else?
For me, it was the most thought-provoking thing. It kind of drew me in. Famous photographers that I knew, like Ansel Adams, when I saw his work, I said, wow, that's what I want to do. I saw that and it just took a hold of me. And ever since then, photography has been it. That's me.
But you never took a class, is that correct?
That is correct.
So this is all a self-taught journey.
Yes, it is. I've actually dived into books. I would spend 2 to 3 hours just looking over material, how to do this, aperture and f-stops, and I just kind of took that to heart, and every day it's a practice, it's a craft. You have to learn it and go forth and just do it.
Did you start with film or did you always start with digital?
It started as digital for me.
But some of those things still apply.
You
still have to know about aperture and f-stops and all those things.
Yes, correct.
And so as you started to learn and you went out and took the photographs and started using Milwaukee pretty much as your canvas, what were you finding out? Were you able really quickly to put thoughts into your photographs, or was it really kind of a ramp-up time?
It was really a ramp-up time. I would walk around Milwaukee and I noticed things that, you know, most people wouldn't see. I looked through Milwaukee photos and I just kind of wanted to point out something very special about Milwaukee.
You know, when you first started and you were learning the craft, as you say, you know, you have to practice that. You have to get the technical skills together. Right. Were you finding that it took a while to be able to produce the photographs that you really saw in your mind's eye, or were you able to do it pretty quickly?
It was kind of both.
Yeah.
You could kind of say the first photograph I took of Milwaukee, it was a complete failure. And I kind of went back to that old work and kind of figure out what I really wanted to portray.
What was the failure in your eye? What was wrong with that first photograph?
The composition wasn't working for me. I found out that, you know, some of the lights at this, like, there's a certain time where you photograph a certain, say, cityscape just to make it glisten. And that first photograph, it just wasn't cutting it. There was that and much more worse things wrong with it that everybody said it looked fine to them, but it didn't look fine to me.
So you hadn't quite gotten to be able to do what you saw.
Right, in my head.
Right.
Yes, correct.
I think that's true for most artists, you know, that, you know, you see what's there, but getting it onto paper or onto canvas or, you know, whatever the medium is always the struggle. For you, since you are self-taught and you are constantly teaching yourself these techniques, how is it going? How many years has it been now since that first photograph and now?
It's been around, I want to say, 6 years.
So obviously things have changed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Things have
changed. And are you happier with getting what you see onto your paper?
Yes. It has been amazing. Ever since then, it has been, for me, changing how I see things around me. Photos that I produce now is much more cleaner, much more stronger than I think. And it's just, I see Milwaukeeans use my work. They post it on their social media and it makes me happy to see people's joy, you know. Even people that leave the States, leave Wisconsin, they say, wow, I miss this place again.
Because of your photographs.
Because of my photographs.
So what is it that you see in Milwaukee that you think other people aren't seeing?
Some people might think it's dirty. Some people think it doesn't have a place. And that's what I aim to do is make its place known.
You're working in digital photography and, you know, the world has changed so much in terms of how quickly pictures can go around the world.
Right.
Are you finding that you're making a living doing this? Are people purchasing your images? Are you able to sell your work?
Yes. I've actually sold to magazines and it's been amazing. Like one or two, three a month and it's been good.
And so you're actually supporting yourself with this?
Yeah.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
A lot of artists don't get to do that.
Yeah. It's crazy because my first major breakthrough, this is 3 years ago, was a major coffee company around the world. And that was really amazing for them to ask me to create two pieces of art for them, you know. I've got approached by Northwestern Mutual. There are two photos, Milwaukee photos, that are locked up in their huge safe. So if anything happens to the city, they'll be there. Other things like from local companies like Uber, that's going around now. I've done some things for them blog-wise. I've shot menus for restaurants around town, and my recent commercial work has been Hotel Metro, which is creating photos for their new website. So all around, like, Milwaukee's giving back. everyone's seen my work, and it's been a pleasure.
One of the things I so like about the photographs of yours that I've seen is that you mentioned Ansel Adams at the beginning of this interview.
Yes.
And I can see his influence because you go in for that black and white and that
really
depth of field, that just blackest of the black, you know, and the contrasts between. And it makes the city – it adds to me – a layer to the city that we don't normally see on a day-by-day basis. And obviously other people are responding to your work in the same way.
Right. Social media is one of the craziest things because words gets around. People, I get emails per day, you know, even 6 to 7 emails asking me, like, where could I get this? You know, where can, you know, I buy this? This is amazing, Valen. Like, you need to make postcards and things like that nature. And yeah, I guess you could say I want people to, you know, look at my photos and feel like this is a city I want to live in. This is Milwaukee. So,
well, I think you've achieved that so far.
Thank you.
How are you thinking about increasing the business? Because you've obviously set up a brand.
Right.
You know, you are Valen AG, and people are responding to it. People are purchasing your work. Are you thinking of expanding out, or is Milwaukee really the canvas that you want to explore?
I'd like to actually just travel, go around traveling and shooting. And I guess, like you said, I do want to expand, maybe to parts of Chicago, maybe go out in Los Angeles and shoot around a bit. But my focus point will be it's centered here because this is where I started, where it all started. I can't deny that, you know.
Is Milwaukee the thing that you're probably going to want to most explore, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I definitely would like to explore more. I do want to create more pieces for Milwaukee, some more amazing, much more depth pieces. I want to work on a street themed for my next project, a street themed series.
Any streets in particular you have in mind?
Wisconsin Avenue.
Okay. Try to see it in a different way.
Right.
Well, you know, Valen, I can't thank you enough. I'm really pleased that you were able to come in today.
Thank you so much, Bonnie.
Valen Gillette is a self-taught Milwaukee-based photographer. He spoke with Bonnie North. You can see some examples of his work online at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's Tuesday's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich. It's great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll tune in again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.